the last occasion when I had the privilege of being here, the focus of the issue was the referee clause, as it has become colloquially referred to, in the contract between the Diamond State Port Corporation and Coon Construction. After argument, an order of this court was issued to address the question that if this referee clause is an arbitration clause, whether or not there are issues of unconscionability. And as a preliminary matter, I know that the question has been raised by the port of whether or not this was expressly raised or whether it's waived or even should be before the court.
And let me interrupt you for just a moment. Since you're, you know, admitted pro hoc vici, we're having an en banc argument.
Yes.
So you should assume all issues are before the court, and the fact that we asked for supplemental briefing on one issue, it's not indicative of any preliminary decision on part of the court. And second, if we've asked for supplemental briefing on something, it's properly before the court.
I understand, Your Honor. I only was addressing the issue raised in the brief of the Diamond State Port that it was not. I agree. I am a member of the Delaware Bar. My office happens to be in.
No, I understand. But a lot of people get confused that if we go on back that and we ask for supplemental briefing, there's a focus. The five of us have not discussed this case. And as far as this argument is concerned, the panel argument never took place. We're starting fresh.
Then, Your Honor, if I may, not only then address the issue of unconscionability, which I can start with, but I would like to revisit the issues of whether or not the arbitration or the referee clause is or is not an arbitration clause as well, because that is the focus of both unconscionability and the question which really brought us to the Chancery Court in the first instance, which is where the clause inserted into the contract says that all matters arising under the contract, the executive director will act as referee, whether that is or is not a true arbitration clause, where, as this contract was written, the AIA 201 standard form was incorporated by reference, which includes the words arbitrator and arbitration, and then was stricken by the court. And there is Article 3 of the contract that says all matters arising under this contract shall be decided by the courts of the state of Delaware.
Would you help me out with a factual issue in regard to striking the AAA clause? At the time contractors chose to bid on this project, did they have before them a contract with an AAA clause that was stricken after they bid, or was the contract presented to them on which they concluded they would bid one that did not have an AAA clause?
The form, the AAA form 201, was included, but pre-bid, the arbitration language was stricken by the port, so that when the contractors who chose to bid, and I'm talking about the second bid, there was a prior bid, and I don't know the answer to the question there, Mr. Chief Justice. The second bid, the arbitration clause had been stricken pre-bid, yet the American arbitration form with certain strikeouts is a part of this contract. So the form which most contractors, indeed, as the amicus brief suggests, contractors, public contractors, know generally that this is the form of contract that is commonly utilized, that prescribes as the dispute resolution process, arbitration. Arbitration was stricken out. The words are in there, but they are lined out. Clause Article 3 speaks directly to all disputes shall be decided by the courts of the state of Delaware. Now, if it were that there was an arbitration clause meaning the referee clause is an arbitration clause, we would be restricted to the Court of Chancery, which is under the Arbitration Act, where disputes would go.
Does it say all disputes are to be resolved under the laws of Delaware, or all claims?
The exact language.
And does it make a difference?
I think it does not make a I believe it talks directly to all issues. The language, I apologize for not having it memorized. I thought I did, but I don't want to misstate it. But I do know that I believe it is all claims. I would be mistaken by trying to guess at this point in time.
Mr. Logan, let me just see if I have the large outlines of your position correctly in mind. Number one, you're arguing that just based on the record in this case, clearly the parties did not intend for the contract to contain an arbitration remedy.
That is correct.
And the referee clause cannot be transmuted into a mandatory arbitration clause.
That is correct.
Therefore, your client is free to seek dispute resolution in the courts of Delaware.
That is correct.
The question, if that is all correct, and I guess we don't have an unconscionability issue, I would gather. My question then is, what function, if any, does the referee clause serve? How does it work?
Certainly. I can answer that, and it does have something to do with the unconscionability. The referee clause reads, the director or his designee shall act as referee in all questions arising under the terms of the contract between the parties. Kuhn Construction understood that to be the day-to-day decision-making process where there is a question under the contract. I believe the illustration when I was here last, I'll do again, was if there is a question of whether or not an element is to be painted red, green, or blue, the director or designee makes that decision, and that is final and binding. There is no question, since it is their port, their dock that is being built, they get to say what they want. They answer the questions, and in fact, during the project, lots of questions have come up. There is a process known as a request for information, that questions are proffered to the port for answer. And invariably, well, with some exceptions, answers are proffered. So that there is no question, day to day, that's what occurred.
Well, let I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Let's assume, to go with your hypothetical, that there's a question about what color to paint something.
Yes.
And the color is determined by the referee, correct?
Yes.
The work is done.
Yes.
And the referee says, well, the color is what I asked for, but the quality of the paint is no good, and the quality of the workmanship is no good, and we're not going to pay you for this work because it's just inferior. Why is that in a different category than what you just described?
The answer is that if there is a determination of a inferior quality of performance, the direction would be to fix it. Question of whether or not should be paid is not strictly within the province of the executive director, because he could then say, I'm not going to pay for anything no matter what I direct you to do. That is the unconscionability segue, that if you are vesting this referee director with the authority to do exactly what you said, come back and say, you know what, I don't like it, I'm not paying it, that's final and binding, and you have no remedy at all. You have now given him absolute carte blanche authority to order extra work and say, I'm not paying for it. And we're saying that's unconscionable.
Well, two points. Justice Berger's question is really an example of a more general concern that I had, which is, it's one thing to say, to have a verbal formula which restricts the referee clause or its function to day-to-day type disputes, and another to draw bright lines in terms of how it actually works in practice. I mean, your formulation, you know, really suggests a continuum at which at some point becomes an issue decidable by the courts and not by the referee. And, you know, I think we're both concerned about how you draw that line where the contract doesn't specify it. Second point is, before we even get to the issue of unconscionability, don't we first have to have some definition of what the function of the clause is? That is, you have to know what animal you have before you can paint it unconscionable or not.
Your Honor, I would agree with you completely, and let me just segue to the facts here of what happened. Under the guise of this referee clause, and it's attached, these are in the record, they are attached to the complaint, here's what happened. Over a period of 8 months, change order requests were submitted to the port, and the port turned them around and said, we're not paying. Okay, you're not paying. The referee, and if we take this as an arbitration matter, the arbitrator initiated a hearing and said, we are going to conduct a hearing. Mr. Bailey wrote a letter and said, we are going to conduct a hearing. Now, looking at the Arbitration Act of Delaware, it says parties initiate arbitration. So we're now off of the Arbitration Act of Delaware. He writes a letter and says, I am going to conduct a arbitration among four parties. Or I'm going to conduct a hearing, is what he says. That four parties are Kuhn Construction, we have a contract with the port, and OCC, they're an engineering firm, who is not a part of our contract, but has a separate contract, and Duffield and Associate, who has a separate contract still. So the parties to this hearing are going to be four, the port ostensibly as a party, and the other three. That was challenged, and again, the writings are attached and part of the record in the complaint, where Kuhn responded and said, you can't do this. First of all, we have no contract with these people, and we don't even know what you're doing. We don't know how you're doing it, what you're doing it, and besides that, you're telling me we have to go first when you're initiating this, and you're the arbitrator or referee. The referee then writes letters asking, well, what do you think about this? To other parties, and even asks, how does the Arbitration Act apply here? Wasn't initiated under the Arbitration Act. He wasn't acting as an arbitrator because it was challenged by Kuhn from the inception.
Okay, well, you know, I can understand instinctually, I mean, we have a limited amount of time here, so we can't dwell on this, but conceptually, it's one thing to use the formula, the verbal formulation, day-to-day decisions, and it's another to operationalize it with some sort of bright line that the parties can use in determining what is a matter for a court and what isn't. That's what we need an answer to.
I understand, Your Honor, but if this is an arbitration clause, then all questions are subject to arbitration.
But my hypothetical,
yes,
takes your position, accepts your position that it's not an arbitration clause.
Okay.
It's a referee clause, and the question is, what function does it serve? And your answer was, it is limited to the resolution of day-to-day type disputes. My question then was, okay, that may be a fine formulation on paper, but how do you operationalize it so that the parties can actually conform their conduct? What is the dividing line, the blank line?
The process actually applied in the field, and maybe I'm not grasping your question, was that if there are questions, there are requests for information, RFIs, there are questions that are posed in writing from Kuhn to the port, how do we address these issues? And they were answered. They were answered. And we got to a point where there were directions to do things which resulted in a change order request saying, we're doing all of what you told us to do.
Let me ask you two questions. The first is, your answer seems to imply questions would be initiated by the contractor. So the questions don't come from the referee, they come from the contractor.
they can come from either the port or the contractor. The referee is an individual designee, and he makes the call. He owns the port.
All right, let's stay with that and go back to Justice Berger's hypothetical.
Yes.
Coon's question under the hypothetical is, what color paint do we use?
Yes.
And the and we get an answer. If the port is not happy with the work, and is that something that goes to the referee or that goes somewhere else? I'm trying to combine Justice Berger's hypothetical with Justice Jacobs' inquiry for a bright line rule. So the color is in, but paying or characterizing work as inferior is not.
Where there is a dispute that evolves from the answers to the question, which would be, okay, you want to do red paint? We'll do it, but that will cost you $10 more. And if the port says, I'm not paying it, we have a dispute. That's not the referee to decide it. That is the courts to decide it, just like any contract dispute.
Could I interrupt you right there? Because I'm looking at what I believe is the referee clause, and it says, on all questions concerning interpretation of plans, it says, and it, after listing various things, says the execution of the work and the determination of payment due or to become due, the decision of the director as designee shall be final and binding. So the referee clause, by its own terms, it seems to me pretty clearly goes beyond just answering questions as to how to do things. It also has to do with evaluating whether the work was performed properly and how much is to be paid, and whether anything is to be paid. So the kinds of disputes that you're telling us should go into a court, it looks like the referee clause specifically addresses.
Your Honor, I respectfully understand what you're saying, but final and binding does not mean final and binding in the contracting realm. Final and binding, just like in the AIA documents, say that the architect's decision is final and binding, yet it is reviewable as to whether that is a correct or incorrect decision. That's where in AAA, American Arbitration Association, there is an architect, and indeed there's supposed to be an architect here as well. And those determinations are made. Then the question is, those are reviewable by, in AAA, a third-party arbitrator, in what we believe to be the case, the courts are available to decide whether or not the decisions of payment or not are correct and consistent with the contract. Otherwise,
so let me stop you there just to see if I understand your answer,
yes,
and that is that when the referee makes a decision, if the arbitration language had not been crossed out pre-bid, and you disagree with the referee, you would have gone to arbitration.
AAA arbitration, yes.
But since the arbitration was crossed out, your argument is if you disagree with the referee, you get to go to court.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is exactly right. That if we disagree, because otherwise we have effectively given, and I need to segue back to what has happened here, the right this referee clause has essentially become a release to the port because they can do anything. And in fact, respectfully, during argument before Vice Chancellor Noble, what was argued was that after it was agreed that what they proposed to do they couldn't do, the colloquy between counsel for the port and Vice Chancellor Noble was that, okay, what we'll do is we'll start a hearing with Coon, we'll subpoena in OCC and Duffield, we'll decide whether or not they should or should not have something to do with it. We'll initiate another thing. But the most important part
Mr. Logan, let me follow up on Justice Holland's question. Your answer was because the arbitration clause was struck, the arbitration language, then review of any decision by the referee is in the courts, correct?
Yes, and there was Article 3 specifically says that in the contract.
But as Justice Berger pointed out, the scope of the authority given to the referee under under the language of the referee clause is so broad that, you know, in particularly the final and binding aspect of it, that there wouldn't be any room for court review. So wouldn't we have to find that, or determine, at least as to the final and binding language, that that part of it is unconscionable?
It is unconscionable if it is read to be an absolute release. And unfortunately,
let me just follow up on that. As I understand the way an arbitration would work, if it went to an arbitrator and you didn't like the result from the arbitrator,
yes,
you could still go into court, but you have very, very limited ability to get review of the arbitration decision. It has to be fraudulent or,
yes,
I don't know what other terms, but basically we don't look at anything except something that is in the nature of fraud. Isn't that pretty much the same thing we have here? So the referee says this is the way it is. That decision is final and binding. You can come into court and challenge that decision, but only if you can prove that there was fraud.
Your Honor, I going back to two pieces, if I can, and I just wanted to make a final point. What was stated to Vice Chancellor Noble by the port was, the port is already exonerated. They owe nothing. So that whatever proceeding goes forward, including the one that they said, well, we can't do what we asked to do, but we want to do something else, Kuhn has no remedy against the party with whom they contract. We've already lost. It's in the record. It's already been said. And in the instance of, is this a, as interpreted, as applied here, conscionable or unconscionable, we, meaning Kuhn, did not understand this to be a way by which the port could accumulate liabilities to Kuhn and say, we have no liability. If you want to go after something, we'll come up with an idea, but not under this contract. In fact, they are saying now we have no contract remedies whatsoever. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. If I believe I am.
You are. You have 2 minutes, and now, by the time I stop talking, 40 seconds.
I thought I could reserve the rest. Thank you.
Fine.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Donald Reed on behalf of the Diamond State Port Corporation, which I will refer to as DSPC. First, in response to the question that was raised in the earlier argument regarding the bid documents, the documents as submitted to all the bidders, both for the initial bid and for the second bid, had the AIA documents as you see them in the record with all the strikeouts. So throughout the time that the parties were looking at the bid documents, they knew what contract they would be asked to sign, and they knew that it would not include the AIA version of the arbitration clause.
But do you agree in that without all of those strikeouts, if there was a disagreement with the referee, you would go to arbitration?
No, Your Honor, I do not, because the problem is if there were not strikeouts, we would have a serious issue, a serious problem, because we would have conflicting clauses. We would have, in effect, two arbitration clauses, and it would be unclear under the contract who was to decide what.
Well, you have conflicting clauses in any event, don't you? As I read the contract, there is a definition of a claim, and there is no definition of a question. And the contract, as I read it, is as follows. In 7.2.1, the following language appears. The director shall act as referee in all questions arising under the terms of the contract between the parties. Then in section 4.3.1, a claim is defined as including disputes and matters in question between the owner and contractor arising out of or relating to the contract. Now, can you tell me, as a practical matter, with both those provisions in the same contract, how one resolves what is a claim and what is a decision, and who resolves a difference of opinion on either?
You know, I believe that you look at 7.2.1, which tells you what's included within the definition of questions. There's a whole listing of things, as Justice Berger referred to earlier. questions concerning interpretation of plans, specification.
Well, what it says, first it says all questions arising under the terms of the contract. Then it says, as if it's, and more specifically, within that larger set, on all questions concerning the interpretation of plans and specifications, et cetera.
Yes.
So is it not fair to read that first sentence as a broad question about anything that arises between the parties under the contract, and then a subset within that on all questions concerning the interpretation of plans and specifications, et cetera? Now, reconcile for me all questions arising under the terms of the contract and claims that include disputes and matters in question between the owner and contract arising out of or relating to the contract. How does any reasonable person decide what is a claim and what is a question and how a dispute on either of the two is to be resolved under this contract?
You know, I think you have to read it as best you can together. As written, 7.2, I agree, all questions means everything. It's all-encompassing. So that has to include claims within it.
Well, what's the point then in making any reference in Article 3 to venue and choice of law? Why refer to courts at all if all questions arising in the contract are to be resolved by the owner's hand-picked dispute resolution person?
Because, Your Honor, there's a couple of reasons for that. At the time the bid documents are put together, it's anticipated that there may be bidders from outside of Delaware, as there were in this case. So there's a very good reason to have Article 3 in the contract so that any bidder who is awarded the bid will consent to the jurisdiction of the courts of Delaware, if necessary. For example, provisions are for disputes like this, where you have a question about whether it should go to the director under the 7.2.1, or if you have a question about enforcing the decision of the director or challenging it. So they have consented to the jurisdiction of the courts for that purpose.
Okay, then help me out with 7.1.1, another one of the so-called special conditions. Claim, as I understand, is defined under general conditions, but then there's special conditions. It says, 7.1.1, the director's decision shall be, quote, final and binding on and shall not be cause for claims by the contractor. Now, that seems to say to me, at least, that there's some distinction between claims and the finality of decisions made by the director.
I think, Your Honor, if you read that provision in context, it's referring to monetary claims. 7.1.1, I believe, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that what we're talking about here? Ultimately, is a monetary claim?
Yes.
Well,
but you have to read the entire provision. 7.1.1 deals with a specific type of issue relating to the owner doing work with its own employees and any claim by the contractor that there's an issue of access or relating to that specific provision.
So it's not the same claims that's defined in 4.3.1, where claims include adjustment or interpretation of contract terms, the payment of money, the extension of time, or other relief with respect to the terms of the contract.
7.1.1 is directed to a specific type of issue.
So it's a different interpretation or definition of claims than what's purported to be the definition of claims for the purpose of the contract?
I believe it's an example of one type of claim, Your Honor.
Well, is your position that a resolution of claims as defined under 4.3.1 is also solely to be done by the director as a part of questions that he's authorized to answer?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, to pick up on that then, let's go back to Justice Berger's hypothetical when she was addressing to Mr. Logan. You would agree, would you not, that the referee in this case would have the authority to tell the contractor whether to use red paint or green paint? you know, on some structure at the port?
As a functional matter, the referee wouldn't decide that. There's people that administer the contract at the port. So it's a lower-level person who would be making those decisions.
But if it went up to the referee, he would be the final decision-maker on that, correct?
If there was a dispute between the Coon and the person who was administering the contract, yes.
Now, what if the referee said, all right, you know, red paint is the order of the day, but I'm only going to authorize compensation for half of what the contractor says it's entitled to. Is that a final and binding decision?
It's our view, Your Honor, that he would have the authority to say...
Is that a final and binding decision not reviewable by a court?
It would be reviewable by the court, as all arbitration decisions are, to the extent of fraud or other examples under the Act. The contractor would have the right to raise a question about we're entitled to more payment and to present its argument to the director as to why it should be entitled to more payment. If that was ultimately denied by the director, then it would be final and binding, just as the examples in the cases we
What if the director didn't afford that due process, just said, this is the way it's going to be? That's still final and binding, isn't it? I mean, subject to, somebody using an arbitration type review.
Yes, and in fact, that's exactly what happened in the cases that dealt with this type of clause before, both DelDOT and the Delaware River and Bay Authority, where there were decisions by it was the director at the Delaware River and Bay Authority and perhaps the secretary at DelDOT, where they had specific disputes like this over amounts due for what's claimed to be extra work and for other things, delays under the contract, and the designated person in each of those cases made a decision as to what compensation was due. It was final and binding, subject to only review, essentially as the arbitration process review is. The same thing for the things that are designated under the Arbitration Act.
Well, if there is arbitration in that way, what determines whether it gets upheld or not, if it's final and binding by the director?
It is final and binding, Your Honor, subject to the review under the examples given in the Act, for example. If there was a showing that there was absolutely no process given to the contractor, it seems to me that would be a basis for overturning the decision. There was no opportunity to present evidence. There was no opportunity to present their position. I think that would constitute...
So all you arbitrate is whether the process was fair?
I believe you mean all you argue about on...
At an arbitration.
At the arbitration, you would argue the issue that was in dispute.
Well, is it your view that the director is an independent, impartial decision maker?
He is as independent as the parties agreed to have a decision maker in this case.
I understand that. I'm talking about objectively. We can hypothetically say, you know, we look at independent directors on boards. We look for independent people to do arbitration and arbitration clauses. I agree the parties could agree to have something done by a person who's not impartial or not independent. But if they hypothetically had agreed to have an impartial, independent arbitrator, would the director qualify?
As I understand Your Honor's question, I think the answer would be no, in the sense that it would be what would amount to be an undisclosed conflict. That's the type of issue that comes up when parties say, we expect to have a third-party independent arbitrator, and they go forward, and then they find out that, in fact, there is some connection between the arbitrator and one of the parties. That has been grounds for overturning an arbitration decision. But when you know ahead of time who the person is and any alleged impartiality or partiality in this case, then the parties have agreed to that person as the arbitrator.
Well, that leads into the unconscionability argument. You use the word agreed. The argument is that this is really a contract of adhesion, and it is, if you want to bid, you have to agree to use our referee, who's the director, who may not otherwise be impartial, but that's the condition for bidding. Is that pretty much the way this contract worked?
Your Honor, we would submit that that's not true. I mean, it was certainly, notice was given to the parties that this is the proposed contract. If the parties believe that that was inappropriate or unfair, the bidders had the right to raise that issue prior to bidding, to say, we believe this is unfair, we believe you should change this. They could have raised it beforehand. None of the six bidders, including Kuhn, raised any question regarding this provision prior to bidding.
But so that argument, or that assumes that they knew it was an arbitration clause.
Certainly, Your Honor. And of course, a party has to read what they're being asked to bid on and asked to sign. And if you read the clause, as broad as it is, with the final and binding language used at least twice, I would submit that you have to understand that it means something, that's something that's final and binding. And Kuhn, as the record shows, in fact, had prior experience with this very type of clause in the past, where it did arbitrate and the arbitration was upheld. So it was on notice that it was an arbitration clause.
When you say arbitrated, you mean had a hearing in front of the hand-picked director?
Yes.
And the outcome
was challenged in court, and it was upheld.
Could I follow up along the same lines here? The clause is called a referee clause, and maybe I'm being too colloquial here, but the idea of a referee is in the nature of an independent party. Now, obviously, the director is not an independent party, but would you take the position that this clause requires the director to act impartially and to reach a conclusion without regard to the potential detrimental impact on the port if he finds in favor of the contractor?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think you'll see in the cases in the record, Wilson and Ruckman, that very issue was discussed, and it was noted that the same language was used there, referee, and the court noted that that means an arbitrator. And what is demanded of that person is, and I forget the exact language, but a good faith decision. He has to act in good faith, knowing that he may be finding against.
Well, it's correct, is it not, that in Ruckman and the other cases that use Ruckman's language, the parties did not raise the issue about whether or not the referee clause was an arbitration clause. The dispute was whether or not a particular subject matter was subject to arbitration under that language.
As a procedural matter, you're correct, Your Honor. None of those cases were challenged prior to it going forward, prior to the dispute going forward before the referee. So they were challenges after the fact to the decision by the referee.
More importantly, none of those cases held that this referee language was disputed as to whether or not it was an arbitration clause and resolved in a holding that indeed, in fact, having listened to both parties argue whether that issue is disputed or not, we hold it is tantamount to an arbitration.
You are correct.
Because all the parties conceded that for the purposes of their dispute, it was an arbitration clause.
You are correct. There was no express holding in the procedural context that you've just described, but the cases did expressly discuss the referee language, meaning an arbitrator, and described them as arbitration clauses, and that they were enforceable and were to be upheld. The decisions of the arbitrator under those clauses were to be upheld.
Now, let's go back to the point you were making before the last question, and that was what the parties would have believed this contract to mean. How is it that a party looking at this contract, which defines claim but does not define decisions, and has a different special condition that talks about certain circumstances involving a contractor and third parties is to how you resolve claims by a director's decision, and then has a venue and choice of law provision How is a party to conclude that there is absolutely no access to the courts to resolve any claim, and that they go into this contract on notice with the arbitration clause language stricken, still attached for reasons that escape me to the contract? They go in, they enter into this contract believing that there is no relief after the director's decision, no matter how arbitrary it may be.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure I followed the entire line of your question, but let me respond as best
I can.
Well,
it's probably not very well articulated, but the bottom line is, given the inconsistencies that a reasonable person could find in this contract, how could we conclude as a matter of fact that anyone entering this contract knew that the director's decision on all issues or claims would be final without recourse to the courts?
Well, let me turn, Your Honor, first to Article 3, which is the choice of law provision, which expressly states on the second page of the contract that the provision is not intended in any way to limit the provisions of Section 7.2 of the special conditions, which are incorporated and made a part of the contract. So that clause, specifically referenced 7.2, tells the parties that the choice of law provision does not mean that you go into court. It says you're going in front of the director for disputes that are final and binding. If the
on that particular point, isn't it logical to read in a business-like way that what this means is every day-to-day decision that's disputed between the construction manager, the general, and the subs, that's ultimately resolved by the director, whether you brought 10-penny or 5-penny nails to the site, whether or not you brought 5x7s or 2x4s, someone says you got it wrong, the director resolves it. That's final. That's a day-to-day kind of decision that needs to be made in order for the contract to move forward in a timely way. When, on the other hand, you have a section that talks about asserting as a matter of right payments of money, adjustment or interpretation of contract terms, referred to as a claim, and with no stated relationship to the referee's decision as opposed to a claim made to the referee, how do you read this language to preclude any reading other than the director's going to make the final decision on everything without recourse to the courts?
I was following you on until the end, and I thought you turned a different way. But let me say that, first of all, I don't think a reasonable person could read the referee clause with its specification of the scope of the clause covering everything from payment to become due or to become due and to be final and binding. The director's decision is final and binding. Anyone reading that has to understand that this is a clause that the director is given authority not for day-to-day decisions, but for ultimate decisions of disputes.
Well, then why doesn't it plainly say all claims and questions arising under the contract? Why is there a distinction made between questions and claims within the same contract?
It's not a perfectly written contract, Your Honor. I would grant you that because
it looks like a cut-and-paste contract to me.
But there are sections from the AII document and then the special conditions which are separately put together. So it's not a perfectly written contract. But a reasonable person reading the referee clause would have to know, with reference to Article 3, that in fact they are going to be in front of the director for any disputes.
Could a reasonable person, particularly one that's involved in the businesses that operate under this and similar contracts, also read it to be ambiguous as to whether a claim can be made in court as opposed to a decision about the plans and specifications being resolved by the director? Are you saying that there is only one way for anyone to read this contract reasonably, and that's your way?
I'm saying that the reasonable way to read it is the way I've described. If someone read it in the way Your Honor is suggesting, then it's our position that they had a duty at the time before the bids were submitted to raise that issue with the port and say, wait a minute, I'm confused. What does this mean? How do these two things go together? That's what the process is designed to do. If they had a problem, if they thought they had an ambiguity, they should have raised that.
Apparently, in many contract situations, neither party thinks there's an ambiguity when they enter into the contract. It's later down the road when they find out that the other party's interpreting the contract differently than they, that they have an issue about how the contract should be interpreted. I don't know of any case law that says if you had a question that arose during the performance of the contract that calls into question the interpretation of a term, if you didn't raise that question before the incident that caused it to arise occurred, you're barred from raising it forever. But that's ludicrous.
I don't believe that's what I was suggesting, Your Honor. What I was suggesting was the reasonable way to read this contract is to read the referee clause to require decisions to be made.
Okay, and my question to you is your position that that is a reasonable way or the only reasonable way to read it?
The only reasonable way, Your Honor.
Then I don't have any other questions.
If I may sum up, Kuhn is a sophisticated contracting company which voluntarily agreed to arbitrate contractual disputes under a clause with which it had prior experience. The clause has been upheld as valid for more than 40 years under Delaware case law, and DelDAT still uses a similar provision as authorized by statute. Accordingly, it cannot be viewed as unconscionable or in violation of Delaware public policy. The Chancery Court correctly ordered Kuhn to arbitrate, and we respectfully submit that the decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Following up on the point of the Chief Justice, indeed, as raised by Kuhn, in 4.3 of this contract, there is a definition of claims and disputes. That is not a question. And in fact, reading through, and I know it's in the briefs, they do use distinctly in the same section claims and questions as being distinct. All claims are not questions. They are not, they define them differently and they use them differently. Finally, going back to the sophistication of Kuhn, going back in time, the Kuhn case that was just referred to was an old DelDAT case when there was no procedure that is now the case, which is Secretary of Transportation renders a decision, and in the event of a dispute, it goes to AAA arbitration. That's the current rules. In the most recent decision that I can find, it was a decision by Federal Judge Sleet in the Mendelson matter, there is a provision that if one reads it, the section says that the director in that instance in the DRBA acts as referee and arbitrator. That conjunction and certainly underscores the fact that Kuhn did not understand referee and arbitrator are the same thing. They are distinct. They have been used in the current time frame, in the current industry as being distinct. If one wants to arbitrate, the word exists. The industry understands it. When you don't want to arbitrate, you strike it out. And if you want to say the referee is the arbitrator, say so. If they want to say the executive director shall be the arbitrator in all matter, say so.
Mr. Rogan,
yes,
let's assume that we agree with your fundamental position, that is that the referee clause is not an arbitration clause, and to the extent that it can be interpreted to give the referee arbitrator-like powers, it's unconscionable. What would be our disposition of the case? Would it be an outright reversal, or would it be a reversal and a remand? And if it's a remand, what would occur on remand?
It would be an outright reversal because what Vice Chancellor Noble did say was to proceed with arbitration as demanded by, and the demand for arbitration came from the port. We are saying that this is not an arbitration clause, therefore reverse the decision of Vice Chancellor Noble. We are free to go to court to have our claims finally adjusted. That's what we believe the answer should be. I am out of time unless there are other questions.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Thank you, Robert.